I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Hidden bonus pay is what State Auditor Nicole Galloway is calling some $2 million worth of compensation given out to top University of Missouri system executives. Today, the auditor tells us why she believes these incentive payments, including housing and vehicle allowances, violate the Missouri Constitution. But first, the power of the written word with one of its greatest advocates, Francine Prose. A Guggenheim Fellow and National Book Award finalist, she shares her thoughts on the threats to freedom of expression and why what we write counts now more than ever. We wrap things up with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Francine Prose is a literary powerhouse. Her 30 books include novels, children's books, and nonfiction. Prose has received a Guggenheim Fellowship. She's been a finalist for the National Book Award, and she served as president of Penn American Center. If one thing can be said of Francine Prose, it is that she lives her belief in the power of the word. Recent pieces for The Guardian have looked at the lack of honesty in our most recent election and suggested a nonviolent national general strike in the U.S. This literary activist is in town as part of a lecture series at the Kansas City Public Library. But before she sits down with Crosby Kemper this evening, she joins me here in the KCUR studios. And welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have
you. Good morning. Thank you.
I should say that your latest novel, Mr. Monkey, is out. It's a wonderfully woven story that centers around a popular children's book that was translated into a really awful musical, but survives in off Broadway productions. All of this was inspired by an outing with your granddaughter. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, that's the sort of non-literary powerhouse part of my life, which I took my granddaughter to a play. I'd been taking her to a lot of Broadway plays, and then the credit card bill came out. And I said, okay, you know, we can't do Lion King anymore, so we can only go to plays. The tickets are $20 and under. So we found this play based on a children's classic novel, and the tickets were $20. And once we got there, it became clear that the budget for the entire program was about what we paid for the tickets. And it was just heartbreaking. I mean, the costumes were falling apart, and the lighting director couldn't find the actors.
So
the,
even in the, New York, right?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, off. There's not enough offs to describe how far from Broadway
this was. I gave you four,
yeah,
I
well,
think. Yeah.
Yeah. About 20 minutes in, I think, my heart just began to break for the actors on stage, because they were all real actors. They could sing, they could dance. And I knew that none of them ever imagined they would wind up in this particular play, in this theater for kids, you know. So, and my granddaughter, who's a very, I guess she was about five at the time, very sensitive, conscious little person, knew that something was going on. And at what she thought was a completely raucous moment in this musical, said, "Grandma, are you interested in this?" And it turned out to be a very quiet or silent moment. And the whole theater heard it, the actors heard it, and I said, again, much too loud, "Yes, of course, I'm extremely interested." And then I had to write the whole novel so I wouldn't have been lying to her. So that's essentially how the novel began, really.
You use the musical to reveal so many characters' lives here, even those a degree or two removed from it. How tough was that for you to create?
It was fun. It was great fun, because at the end of each chapter, I would just think, who from this chapter interests me most? And in a way, the process of writing it was sort of like following people down the street. I mean, that is, I would just pick someone out of the crowd in one chapter and follow that person down the street in the next chapter. So what begins in the point of view of a middle-aged woman actress playing in this heartbreaking musical, the second chapter is written from this little boy, a teenage boy, mm-hmm. who's in the musical. Mm-hmm. And then the grandfather who takes his grandson. I mean, of course, if you change genders, no one recognizes you. So
that helps.
You know, I am not the grandfather. The grandfather and then the grandson and so forth. And then, you know, there's a funny thing when you're working on a novel. Life kind of gives you the thing you need. I mean, you're just waiting and then something happens. So, for example, that same granddaughter who was in kindergarten at the time, said to me that her kindergarten teacher said to the class, every night at 11 o'clock, I take a sleeping pill. Mm. I said, she said that to your kindergarten class? She goes, yeah. So then I thought, oh, I have to write a chapter from the point of view of the teacher of the little boy who's gone to the play, starting with the sleeping pill addiction. So it just went on and on and on. And then I knew it had to circle back to the play. So the last chapter is from the point of view of the director who everyone's been kind of dumping on through the whole novel. But there are a lot of characters, but I wanted everyone, there's one character in the entire book who's not sympathetic, and I wanted everyone else to be sympathetic. So I knew by the end I had to redeem the director who had been the object of so much scorn and antipathy.
Well, I mentioned in the opening you've written 30 books. You make this sound like writing this thing was so easy, and yet it sounds like there's a lot of moving parts here. Give someone like me some comfort here that it wasn't as easy as you're making it out to be.
This one, you know, some of them are
just rolled out.
Some of them are torture and some of them are fun. You know, there's a range. So some of them have been really, really hard. And this one was a kind of pleasure, which doesn't mean to say that there weren't moments when I would say, this is the worst thing anyone ever wrote. I should tear it. There's this great phrase, William Burroughs said something like, the temptation to tear your work up into tiny pieces and throw it in someone else's garbage can. Well, I had that moment, plenty of those moments. But
you still go through that even now.
Oh, yeah. And it's worse. I mean, it's worse than ever.
Because you think you should know better at this point in your life.
Yeah. And why am I still reinventing the wheel? But in a way, you want to pick something more difficult than the things you know, there's so many things now I could do without thinking about them very, very hard. But you want something kind of harder.
I was going to say, speaking of harder, you pack so much into this novel. You're questioning one's life choices, adult love you take on, pubescent love, familial love, environmental threats, infidelity, education, evolution, parenting, mythology. I'm probably missing something here. How much of this was part of your original idea for the book, and how much of it came along as you built this thing as you wrote?
Well, the one thing I knew was that my horror was that someone in the actual play would recognize themselves because you know, they were suffering enough, obviously, without having to appear in my
novel.
They don't need to pile on.
Yeah.
So I had to invent another play. You know, the play that I saw was obviously not Mr. Monkey. So I had to invent a whole other play, musical, songs, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then one thing led to another. I mean, the minute a monkey comes up, then the subject of evolution comes up. Then, Charles Darwin, I had to go back and read some Charles Darwin. So one thing kind of led to another. And then, you know, there's always backwriting. That is, if something comes up in a later chapter that I need a kind of justification for, then I can go back and put it in an earlier chapter.
That sounds like a lot of stuff. That sounds hard.
Yeah. You know, I'd rather do it than just about anything else, seriously.
Well, the review of Mr. Monkey in the Times ended with this, and I'm quoting, "It's just a book to be treasured, but jewel and gem have been diminished in a critical context. So let me use another word, which cannot be diminished. Chekhovian. It's that good. It's that funny. It's that sad. It's that deceptive and deep." What are your thoughts about being compared to Chekhov?
I wept. I actually, tears were sheeting down my face when I read that review. And a friend of mine had found it much earlier than it came out and sent it to me. And we were at a friend's house for dinner. And I opened it on my phone. We got in the car and I just started weeping. And my husband said, "What are you crying about now?" Because the book's been out for a week and you've been doing nothing but crying that nothing's going to happen. And I said, "Well, listen to this." And I just read him those parts aloud. I was profoundly moved and happy. I mean, it was, you know,
How could you not be?
Of course. And it was so validating. You know, I thought, okay, because she really got the whole project. I mean, she talked about the book and then she talked a little about the other things I do. And I just felt, it just felt very validating, like someone understood what I've been trying to do all this time.
Especially after you considered at one point tearing up the manuscript into tiny little pieces.
At several points.
Several points. Excuse me. Yeah.
Would that it would only have been one point. So.
Do you have a process for book writing? I mean, can you lend listeners who might be interested in this a hand here? Is there a process that you've employed?
Well, I think in general, I mean, one of the things I try to do is get the first draft done as quickly as possible, because that's the scary thing when you have nothing there.
Yes.
You know, once
yes.
you have something, then you can work with it.
And yes.
you, for example, you know you can finish it because it's been finished. Then you can go back and change it and revise it and so forth. But
so does that mean you really force yourself to kick it out the first draft, even though you know it may not be that good?
Yeah, I'm working on something now, and I was just kind of automatic writing for a while, you know, just doing it as fast as so. Now I go back, even though it's typed, I can't figure out what it is because it doesn't have any relation to English spelling, as far as I can tell. So I'm just trying to parse out what I could possibly have been thinking. But yeah, I think it's, you know, whatever you can do, because basically, writing's scary, I think. It really, you know, and it doesn't stop being scary.
That's amazing for me to hear you say that after this, after New York Times compares you to Chekhov.
Yeah,
you know?
Well. And so whatever you can do to kind of trick yourself into doing it, and a friend of mine used to refer to this little Jiminy Cricket editor thing that would sit on your shoulder and say, terrible, 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 terrible.
What are you doing? Yeah.
So whatever you can do to make that thing shut up, that's the way to go, I think.
You know, and this is not any comparison to what you do. I write in small chunks for a newspaper, you know, for the editorial page at the Star and for other things. And, you know, I'm the same way. I want to get the first draft out, just bleed it out. And from then, you just feel yourself relax completely because you know you're going to meet your deadline. And then you can go back and monkey with it. And monkeying with it at that point is a whole lot easier than having to start from scratch.
And it's fun. Revising's fun. I mean, you can make it work out the way you want it to. Do you have a word limit when you are writing for the editorial?
Yes. Yes.
Isn't it interesting the way when someone says 800 words, you wind up doing 800 words? I mean, I've noticed that over the years, that somehow if somebody says 1,200 words, it just forms itself as a 1,200-word piece.
Yes, and the other thing I've noticed is that a lot of times in a first draft, I'll just cram it through. I won't look at the word count, and my 450 words will be 700. Then I have this panic. I think, oh, I've gone way over. Can I bring it back? And what's amazing is you can every single time. You can take those 700 and trim it back because there's so much fluff and junk in there you really don't need.
The word counter on your computer is a beautiful thing.
Yes. Or an evil thing, depending on how you want to look at it. My guest is writer Francine Prose. She's in town for tonight's. She's the featured guest in the ongoing Maria Rosa Menocal Lecture Series. The program begins at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. You can reserve a seat at kclibrary.org. I want to turn to other topics you've written about in various publications, Francine, and let's begin with one involving an incident at the Plaza Branch of the library here in town. Last May, former Ambassador Dennis Ross was the guest speaking about Truman and Israel. A Q&A period was part of the program, and as you noted, nobody was to be prevented from asking a controversial question. Yet, when a local activist did just that, security personnel on site for the evening moved to eject him. At that point, the library's Steve Woolfolk stepped in to defend the guest's right to be there and to ask the question. Long story short, both men were removed from the room, handcuffed and arrested. We understand that Mr. Woolfolk, who was charged with interfering with an arrest, is in court this very morning on the matter. Your article, When Librarians Are Silenced, saw this as another in a growing number of attacks on libraries. What else has happened, and why should we be concerned?
Well, I was very glad to be able to write the piece. I mean, the way it started really was that Crosby Kemper, who's the director of the library, and I had been in correspondence about my coming out to talk as part of the Maria Menocal series. And then I didn't hear from him for a while, and I just kind of let it go.
Like, what's up?
And then he wrote back and said, well, I'm sorry for the delay or for having been absent, but I've been trying to keep one of my librarians out of jail, which is how I heard about it. And it was horrifying. But also, I'd been wanting to write about libraries and the importance of libraries and the relationship of libraries to democracy, freedom of speech, communities, and so forth. When I was with Penn, there was a case that came up, and we gave an award then to librarians from Eastern Washington State. And this was not that long after the Patriot Act had gone into effect. And the FBI came into the library and asked for their borrowing records because someone had written some notations in a biography of Osama bin Laden. And the librarian said, I don't think so. And their board supported them, and they were these—
Supported who?
The librarians. And they were these gutsy women who stood up to the FBI, you know, for the freedom of borrowing and so forth. And so this was not a terrorist. This was someone who was reading a biography.
Right.
So, and the American Library Association has been out on the front lines of defending freedom of speech long before a lot of other human rights organizations and so forth got the importance of this. So so librarians are heroes, have been heroes in this way. And also, the libraries are so important. I mean, they were important to me as a kid. I don't know any writer who didn't spend a lot of time in the library when they were kids. And now
it's amazing to me that they not only continue, but they're thriving in so many ways. And Crosby Kemper last night was talking about traffic coming into the library and how those numbers tend to go up. And it's amazing in this day and age, this internet era we live in, that they are as vital today as they've been for a long time.
Amazing. And also, I mean, there are many startling things. For example, one of the things the libraries know, which I think most people don't know, or a lot of people don't know, is how many people don't have access to computers in their homes. So they come to the library and they can apply for jobs or, you know, do all the things that so many of us take for granted because we have it on our phones and everywhere we go. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And then there are more and more programs that are started in libraries. I mean, they're helping people get citizenship. They're dealing with immigration issues. There are programs for children. There are programs for seniors. Yeah. I mean, they've become these vital, thriving community centers.
How much do you worry about the value of the written word and how maybe that's been diminished in the internet era when there's so many words coming at people every day?
Of course I worry about it. I mean, my younger granddaughter, the first time she opened a book, she was like two maybe, she tried to swipe it as if it were a cell phone or a tablet. You know, she just like opened the book and just moved her hand from one of the. So what does that tell you about people, about books? I mean, I think we're all worried about it, but I think people, you know, even if they're reading books on their electronic devices, I mean, I prefer to read books as what they now call physical books, they're still reading. I mean, a friend of mine, a writer, says people have been talking about how the novel is dead for dozens of years, but the novel's going to be around at our funeral. So yeah. I think it'll survive.
Let's turn to the election, because you've had a lot to say about that too, Francine. Writing in The Guardian this past December, your piece, "Truth is Evaporating Before Our Eyes," included this, and again I'm quoting here, "And when the biggest liar won the election, one conclusion to be drawn was that for millions of Americans, honesty was not nearly so important as we might have wished or assumed. If we factor in the popular assumption that all politicians lie, perhaps all that mattered was what they lied about." And I'm wondering, how much damage did that campaign do to freedom of expression? And has it now become equated with the freedom to lie?
Well, it's an incredibly complicated issue, freedom of speech, because freedom of speech is indivisible. I mean, it's defended by the Constitution. You can say what you want. I mean, there's complications now about hate speech and so forth, and it varies from, but essentially it is, and I think it should be, indivisible. You can say what you want. On the other hand, there's this other dimension to it, which is I call it a moral dimension. I mean, that is when you speak in public, and especially if you're a political candidate or the president of the United States, you're modeling a certain kind of behavior to the world and to the people and to kids and so forth. And when what you're saying is clearly untrue, you can certainly say it. I mean, our Constitution defends your right to be able to say it. Mm-hmm. But to essentially say to people, it doesn't matter if you tell the truth or not, I think is really wrong. I mean, not illegal, certainly defensible, but just wrong. So there's a legal issue, and then there's a moral issue, and they're not quite the same.
Well, that's on one side of the equation. The other side of the equation is that so many folks believe the lies.
Well, that's one of the most dangerous things I think that's going on. You know, the whole sort of fake news. I mean, someone at the library yesterday said the equation of real news and fake news. There is such a thing as real news. Certain things actually happen and certain things didn't happen. And those things, I mean, one of the reasons we depend on newspapers, on NPR and so forth, is on the simplest level to tell us what happened. We're not everywhere. We can't see it with our own eyes. And there has to be some source we trust to say, this happened, this didn't happen.
So what does all this sort of represent going forward for our collective lives as a society, as a culture? What are your concerns as you look down the road?
You know, if I had to pick my single biggest concern, I mean, I have two right now. I mean, just on the immediate level, I'm obsessed and horrified by the deportations that are going on. I mean, people's lives are being ruined right now. You know, you hear these stories of some father of four dropping his kids off for school
right.
and detained by ICE people because
right.
of, you know, a 10-year-old DUI or something. I mean, awful. Aside from that, or in addition to that, I'm so worried about the educational system because that's what, you know, that's where people learn to read. That's where people learn to process information. That's where people learn to distinguish fake news from real news, or who you can trust, or how you make a judgment, or how you tell if what you're being told is true or lie. And the more our educational system gets diminished, and under the new Secretary of Education, I don't feel very hopeful about it, the harder it is for us to reconstitute a society in which these things matter and are possible for people.
You know, you clearly have issues with President Trump, and I'm wondering, what's your deepest fear about where this country will be nearly 4 years from now once this first term is over?
Deepest fear?
Yeah.
Well, I think everyone, you know, I mean, the sort of thing people say is, maybe it will be okay if he doesn't kill us all. I mean, there's the deepest fear, of course, is nuclear war. I mean, this is someone who's clearly showing himself to be, have, how do I put this, an impulse control problem. Mm. And, you know, what's the difference between tweeting some insane story at 3 o'clock in the morning and deciding just let's nuke it all and get it over with? I hope there's, you know, there are enough checks and balances there. And then the idea of a sort of, you know, what I think everybody is worried about is in the event, the not unlikely event of some sort of terrorist attack and the way in which fear can motivate people to change their beliefs or to look for a leader or whatever, you know, suddenly we find ourselves under military rule. I mean, that can happen. So, you know, for the first time, really, my deepest fears are pretty deep. They're pretty extreme. I mean, there were things I worried about under previous administrations, but this one's pretty far out there.
And there have been these polls done of Americans about anxiety levels being up for so many citizens because of the change in administration. Of course, the numbers for Democrats much higher than for Republicans, and it sounds like you're squarely in that camp.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, right now, the Trump administration seems to have declared war on most of the press. How worried are you that it may extend at some point to writers like yourself, Francine, who are at odds with the president? I mean, after all, another article you wrote suggested a general national strike in the U.S. to protest our current government's callousness. What did you have in mind?
Well, I thought, you know, what I said in the article was that political movements rarely succeed unless they cause some sort of discomfort and disruption. Actually, today, there's supposed to be a women's strike. I mean, here I am, obviously, not participating. But there's supposed to be it's International Women's Day. So a day without women is supposed to be today.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, we don't in this country have a tradition of general strikes. In Europe, they do. But it would be, I think it would be great if the labor unions got involved or, you know, workers got involved. I mean, I was...
And just walked out for a day.
Just walked out for a day, you mm-hmm. know, because economics drives so much. And once, you know, once people started boycotting Ivanka Trump's products, you know, oh my God, there was a huge outcry. It got noticed. So I think that kind of thing. And I was, when I wrote that piece, I was just kind of floating this idea, you know, because it seemed like an idea. And I was really astonished by the response I got. Well, The Guardian said to me that there were something like 120,000 shares of organic shares, whatever. I mean, people were just sending this all over. And then I would hear these stories. My son said a friend of his who lives in, I think, Mississippi, said that he worked on barges in the river and that the guys on barges in the river had been reading this and saying, you know, what a great idea. We could shut down the river for a day if we needed to. So, you know, it got out much further than a bunch of lefty intellectual Guardian readers. I mean, it really got out there because...
What's happened in our country about this idea of striking, though? Because you don't hear of it as often as maybe when I was a kid. It was more common back then, less common now, and why?
Well, for one thing, I think the labor unions have gotten so much weaker and
yeah.
so forth. But, you know, what it was 2 days ago, they essentially dismantled the Occupational Safety and Health Act. So that is, you know, now you get injured on the job, too bad, try and sue, see how that works out for you. So
mm-hmm.
maybe if enough workers realize that their rights are being compromised, there'll be much more activity. I mean, that's my hope. And
are other authors adding their voices to yours here?
Yeah.
Has this become a movement in the literary world?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are lots of, there was, I mean, well, Penn, for example, had a Writers Resist, Speak Out, and the Steps of the New York Public Library. I mean, there were so many writers. I have to say that the event was sort of unbearable. It was the dead of winter, and it went on for 3 hours, and you know, many of us kept going to the bathroom because it was warm, and that was the only place we could go. But, you know, there's a Writers Resist movement that's all over the country. And that day, I think it was in, it was in January, it was around the inauguration, there were readings all over the country. So, yeah.
Just a final thing. How would you rate the president in his use of words? Because, at least on some levels, they seem to be pretty effective.
I just like to say that TAP has one P. I
mean,
you know, I think that he, you know, the writers care a lot about the English language. And one of the things I really liked about Obama was he was quite eloquent when he spoke. Trump's language is just, in many cases, just awful. And he just doesn't seem to care about the language particularly. And that's not good for anyone, I don't think.
Francine Prose speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, just go online, kclibrary.org. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so
much. Enjoy your time in Kansas City, Francine.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a scathing new audit of the University of Missouri system from Missouri State Auditor Nicole Galloway. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we heard some of the defining songs of the Vietnam War and learned the history of the electric guitar. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, learn how Dodge City, Kansas earned its reputation as the wickedest town in the West. And we'll meet Calvin Hayden, who took over the Johnson County Sheriff's Department back in January. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, Missouri State Auditor Nicole Galloway is out with a scathing new audit of the University of Missouri system that questions how the system is paying top administrators. At issue, $2.4 million in off-payroll compensation for these officials, including the legality of $1.2 million in incentive money that went to administrators since July of 2014. The system contends that many of the payments are all part of competing for top talent in a very competitive field. Galloway disputes that. Among her findings are payments made to UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton. Auditor Nicole Galloway joins us now. And Nicole, good morning.
Good morning.
Just a quick note, UMKC holds the operating license for this station and know that I teach journalism here on campus. You said the other day, Nicole, that you were concerned with what your office uncovered here, and I'm wondering why.
Well, you know, what we found were hidden bonuses paid to top administrators within the UM system. And, you know, when families take out debt, when they save for years to send their kids to college, when we are in a limited resource environment here within our state budget and the support that we have for higher education and funding, you know, I am deeply concerned about how our tuition dollars and our tax dollars are being spent. And when these bonuses are hidden and not open to the public, you know, that's disturbing to me.
The university says you're nitpicking here, though, Nicole, and it contends that this is all part of the cost of doing business and recruiting and retaining top talent. If that's the case, what's so wrong here?
You know, I wouldn't say that over $2 million is nitpicking. That is a significant dollar amount. And look, what we're talking about here is the definition between bonuses and incentive pay. You know, if there is a true incentive program, then extra compensation is tied to clear, measurable, objective measures that incentivize high performance. The system does not have that in place. So, for instance, you know, if you come from the private sector, as I do, you know what incentive pay is. It's not guaranteed compensation. You have to earn it above your normal job responsibilities. What it looks like here with the combination of these hidden bonuses and luxury vehicle allowance, it just looks like a way to boost administrator salaries without having to tell the public about it.
You say here, again, very clearly, that this incentive payments are a violation of the Missouri Constitution, no less. Why are these bonuses a violation of a document as grand as the state constitution?
The Constitution does not allow for compensation for work already performed. So you can't have a bonus provided at the end of a fiscal year, for instance, because that work has already been performed. So the Constitution does not allow for bonuses. You know, what I would say is that, you know, the university just completed hiring a new system president that came from a university outside of the state. They did a national search. The university president has refused to accept these type of incentive bonuses. So for me, some of these arguments don't hold water.
Well, even he came out in a statement just the other day saying this, Nicole, our executive compensation program is critical to our capacity to attract and retain top leaders in what is an extremely competitive national higher education market. And other officials point out that the UM system has lost several key officials to other states in recent years. Apparently, that's a big concern inside the system.
You know, to me, you still just can't have hidden bonuses. And look, if there is a strong defense for the amounts that were involved and the amounts that were paid, then why not just make it open to the public? Why not include those in publicly disclosed salaries? And so, you know, if there was measurable criteria with incentives to have high performance from these leaders, then have that incentive program in place and publicly disclose it. But that is not what we found here.
But again, the system insists that there was a formalized process of some kind for determining how this compensation would be earned. But you're saying you didn't find that.
That's correct. I mean, that is part of the problem, is that they did not have objective criteria with measurements for performance. The program that they're describing that they have in place is just to give these executives and administrators higher compensation. That is the whole point of that rule and that program. What we're saying is when you do that and you don't have any sort of measurable criteria and it's hidden from the public,
right,
then it's a hidden bonus.
My guest is Missouri State Auditor Nicole Galloway. Was the decision to make these payments, was it made at a public meeting, Nicole? Was there reporting on it in newspapers at the time?
You know, there have been several instances, because I have followed this in media reports, in which reporters have asked for the compensation for administrators and were only given their base salary amount. That's part of the problem, that these luxury vehicle allowances, housing allowances, relocation allowances, and these bonuses were not provided to the public and disclosed. So on top of what their salaries are that they would provide, they received all these additional payments.
What did the system say about that fact, that there was no transparency about how much these individuals were actually making?
In the responses to the audit, which are included in the audit report,
mm-hmm.
So the system administration gets a copy of the report and can provide the responses that are included in the report. They indicate that they will strive to increase transparency.
I should note that Chancellor Morton here at UMKC received about $79,000 in incentive payments over these three fiscal years that are in question here. Was that amount consistent with other chancellors in the system, Nicole?
You know, there were several different amounts that were given to other chancellors. So some were in the form of bonuses and relocation allowances. If you look, There's a little bit of difference between each one. So, for instance, Arbo and Lofton received about $100,000 in retention payments. He also received a $50,000 travel allowance. Cheryl Schrader from
Arbo and Lofton, I should point out, resigned as chancellor of the Columbia campus back in, just a few months ago, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So the amounts vary across campuses and across administrators.
Do we know why these officials received differing amounts? I mean, would that be a sign that there was some sort of system in place for determining who got what size of incentive payment?
you know, we could not find consistent criteria on the amounts. When it came to the bonuses, folks could receive somewhere between up to 10% of their base salary. And what we found pretty consistently is that everyone earned somewhere between 7.5% and up to 9.5% consistently year after year, even after the events that happened on Mizzou's campus in 2015 and beyond. Folks still received their full bonus pay. And so there really, again, shows that there's no measurable criteria for how this bonus and extra compensation is being earned.
I've read that chancellors' contracts themselves include this incentive program and this payment that you just mentioned of up to 10% of salary for meeting goals. It's actually built into the contracts, but it sounds like you're saying that even though that's the case, you could find no criteria for what that incentive would be.
Right, right. And so some of the criteria that you're referring to is very general and is basically what their responsibilities and their what their job responsibilities would be anyway. Incentive payments are supposed to be for additional compensation earned to meet higher goals, to have some sort of metrics. And again, when you request what these folks' salaries are year after year, these incentive payments, these vehicle allowances, et cetera, were not disclosed to the public.
Do other universities around the country offer the same sort of incentives, Nicole? I mean, is what the Missouri system did here, is that unusual in some way?
We did not compare university compensation from Missouri to other states. That is outside of the scope of what we reviewed here. Again, I would say that, you know, given where we are in terms of Missouri's higher education funding in the state budget, it's tone deaf that the university would point to other states to excuse these types of compensation arrangements.
But the system also said that the incentives used here are also used among peer universities and don't exceed the market median. And again, in response to that, you told a newspaper that, hey, that response is tone deaf. Walk me down the road there. Why is that tone deaf in your view?
Well, you know, given where we are in our budget, you know, there has been significant cuts to higher education. We're in a $500 million budget hole for the next fiscal year here in this state. And so, you know, when we're talking about hidden bonuses, given that folks didn't know about, you know, that's a great area of concern. You know, and as I pointed out earlier, that you know, a national search was just completed for a president that came from a university outside of our state, and he specifically and publicly refused to accept incentive bonuses, incentive payments, because he recognized that he doesn't need additional compensation to do what his job responsibilities are to begin with. You know, I think this all circles back around to through these incentive payments, through these luxury vehicle allowances, what the system leaders were trying to do was to raise the compensation and raise the salary of these administrators without having to tell the public about it, without having to publicly disclose it.
I'm visiting with Missouri State Auditor Nicole Galloway about her very critical audit of the University of Missouri system and how it pays its top administrators. Give me a sense of how your officials decided to audit the system. Is this a routine sort of thing? And can you give us some sense of how you uncovered what you did? Is there some detective work that goes on here?
Well, this was part of a higher education audit initiative that we launched last year. So we audited the Department of Higher Education at the statewide level. We looked at funding and affordability of colleges and universities in our state. We looked at performance funding, and then we looked at the UM system administration and the board of curators and the president. So this is the final phase of the higher education audits that we had announced over a year ago. When we do our audit work, part of what we do is look at disbursements, look at the money coming in and the money going out. And we started to notice that there were payments that did not match with some public records that were available, started to dig in further, ask a lot more questions, because as an auditor, when things look suspicious or don't seem right, you know, part of our job is to continue to dig, continue to ask questions, ask for documentation and evidence until we can get to the bottom of things.
Hey, how many auditors work on something like this?
We had a team of auditors, so there were at least three auditors working on this over a period of time.
And when did you start looking at it?
We started this audit last year, and in the audit process, I think it's important to point out that, you know, we conduct field work, so we're there, we're asking for documentation, we go back to our office, we continue to ask questions and documentation and ask for documentation as we throw through it. So while the audit does take a period of time, it's not as if we're sitting in University Hall for months and months and months. You know, this is a long process. When we get to a phase with a draft report, we provide that report to the system, to the leaders of the system, to review for accuracy, and to provide their responses, which are included in the audit report, before it's ever released to the public.
So how cooperative were university officials with your staff and with what you came up here, with what you came up with here?
You know, there was, you know, as with any audit, there is some back and forth when you're requesting additional information or additional documentation. You know, what we received and what the system was able to provide us is all reflected within the audit report.
Were they cooperative?
You know, overall, I would say that they were cooperative. Mm-hmm. You know, we did ask several follow-up questions as we started to dig in. And, you know, we did go back and forth, but that's the natural part of an audit.
You also reported in here, and we've mentioned this name, that R. Bowen Lofton, who resigned as chancellor of the Columbia campus several months ago, he continued to receive his chancellor's salary over the following 6 months, though you said he had no job title and no official responsibilities. You have called that action financial mismanagement. Why?
When Lofton resigned his position in November of 2015, he continued to receive a chancellor salary, hundreds of thousands of dollars over the next 6 months. Again, as you said, with no official duties, he was not officially employed in any capacity.
You said he received hundreds of thousands of dollars even in that interim time.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Wow.
And so then when he had a new contract that was signed in June of 2016, so about 6 months later, he received compensation that was higher than people in comparable positions, $100,000 in retention payments, $15,000 in luxury vehicle allowance, $35,000 in an annual stipend, and then took the remaining 6 months of 2016 to travel the state, to travel the nation, with another $50,000 travel budget. And so received about $500,000 over the course of a year. And we asked the system, you know, provide documentation on what the job responsibilities are, the work product due. That was not something that they could provide and explain. So, you know, really, he received that money with no work responsibilities or work product due over the course of that year.
You've indicated, Nicole, that you're not done with this issue. What's your office's next step going to be here?
Well, our next step is to follow up with our findings and make sure that corrective action has been taken. We will initiate a follow-up review later this year to make sure that the Board of Curators and the system administration has taken responsibility for these things and are beginning to build credibility with taxpayers, students, faculty, and staff.
That's Missouri State Auditor Nicole Galloway. Nicole, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with us for this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I'm very well, Steve.
You've got a band you want to talk about this week that's familiar to a whole lot of people in Kansas City. Tell us about the Elders.
Yes, if Tech N9ne has been the most popular solo act in Kansas City for the last 17 years, the Elders are certainly the most popular band in Kansas City.
They've been around a long time.
Yeah, they've been around for a long time. They've released more than 10 albums. They have DVDs out. They travel the world. They're kind of a big deal here.
Let's listen to The Elders. This track is Meeting of the Waters from their 2014 album, Story Road. That's The Elders. I'm hearing definitely a little U2 in there, Bill.
There's no mistaking that style of guitar. They're clearly influenced by U2.
Who else is inspiring The Elders in your view?
You know, in my mind, Steve, you know, we've got a lot of heartland rock here. So there's some Bob Seger, there's some John Mellencamp, you know, that type of thing happened. And that's, I think, one reason they resonate so well here in Kansas City. You know, there's clearly a tinge of the Irish. You can hear Ian Burns' lilt there. He's a native of Ireland who's lived in Kansas City for some time now. But yeah, that combination of British rock, heartland rock, and just a touch of Irish flavoring appeals to people here in their hometown.
And this is sort of a family affair, right, with The Elders, because you've got a dad on vocals and his son playing drums.
Yeah, son Keen recently, well, a few years ago now, joined the band on drums. And yeah, when you're around this long, there's going to be, you know, some evolution in the lineup. They recently added a fiddler to the lineup, and I'm sure she's going to be a highlight of Saturday's show at Knuckleheads.
And these guys just keep rolling on despite the fact the lineup has changed over the years.
Yeah, you know, they have tapped into what resonates here, and there's no reason they shouldn't be going this strong 17 years from now.
And one real criterion for fame is they've played at the Plaza lighting ceremony before, I think.
Yeah, they've become the default band for civic ceremonies. And yeah, you know, so if you need to gather a crowd or to please a big crowd, The Elders have been the go-to band for several years now.
They'll be playing Saturday night at Knuckleheads.
At Knuckleheads, they'll be in the garage. It's their annual Hooli, their 15th annual Irish party.
That's Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, the history of Dodge City, Kansas, and a visit with Johnson County's new sheriff. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.